Sonia Pressman Fuentes was born in Berlin, Germany in 1928. Her family emigrated to the United States in 1934 to escape the Nazis, and Sonia became a prominent feminist activist, lawyer, speaker, and author. She has written and spoken extensively, both in the United States and abroad, about women's rights, as well as about the immigrant experience. We caught up with her at the International Association of Yiddish Clubs conference, where she gave a talk about how being an immigrant influenced her life.
Thanks for speaking with us, Sonia. You have a really, really interesting background, and not only your own personal background, but what you've done later. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I was born in Berlin, Germany, of Polish parents. And my father was in business in Berlin, and then when the Nazis came to power in 1933, my brother urged us to leave. My father was reluctant to do so because we had lived in Germany, not I, but my family had lived in Germany 20 years. But we left in 33.
Smart.
Went first to Antwerp, Belgium for about 9 months, and then we came to the United States on May 1st, 1934. But if I go into my whole life, it'll take all the time we have, so what do you want me to do?
Well, highlights. Go into the highlights.
All right. I grew up in the Catskill Mountains of New York. I went to undergraduate school at Cornell. And then I went to law school at the University of Miami, Florida. And the reason I did all those things was that I felt, because of my background, that I was not free just to pursue happiness and get married and have a family, as most other young women were. But there were three factors that were pressures on me. One, my life had been saved from the Holocaust by my coming to the United States. Secondly, I was bright. And thirdly, my mother had gone to have an abortion when she was pregnant with me, because she'd had a number of them in the past, because she told me it wasn't customary for well-to-do people to have a lot of children, and she'd already had my brother, who was 14 years my senior. So she went to have an abortion with me, and the doctor was out of town that weekend. So that's why I was born. So all of that made me feel that my life had been saved because it was something I needed to do in the world.
So what did you do?
Well, when I graduated from law school, I went to work in Washington, D.C. for the federal government, and then I got the job that I was meant to hold. I became the first woman attorney in the Office of the General Counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington, D.C. And that was a brand new agency that had opened in July of 1965. I joined it in October of 65. That agency was enforcing a brand new law that prohibited employment discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin, later age, and discrimination based on physical or mental handicaps were added.
Do these really work? I mean, they can tell what race you are when you make an application, and they can tell what sex you are. Do these laws really work, do you think?
Absolutely, because they don't have to work by themselves. The way they work is, let's talk about sex discrimination, my specialty. If a woman applies for a job or is on a job and feels she's the victim of employment discrimination, all she has to do is go to her nearest office of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, known as the EEOC, and file a charge. And then the agency will process it. So the law works through people filing complaints. Mm-hmm. And the EEOC commissioners can also file complaints.
Have there been many?
Oh, yes. I left the agency in 73, but I'm sure there have been thousands and millions of complaints, and that's one of the problems, because the EEOC doesn't have the staff or the budget really to process all the complaints. But the complainant has the option, after the EEOC has had the complaint for 60 days, to get a lawyer and file a lawsuit.
Okay, so then what did you do?
Well, while I was working at the EEOC, a woman writer came there to interview my boss, the general counsel, and the deputy general counsel. and her name was Betty Friedan. And she had published in 1963 a book called The Feminine Mystique. So she came to the office because she thought she was going to write a book about all the progress that women had achieved since she wrote The Feminine Mystique. And she saw me there, another woman, so she began to ask me, what are the problems here? What are the conflicts? Because she's a writer and she was looking for conflict. I was afraid to speak to her because I thought if I told her the truth, I would lose my job. The truth was that for the first year and a half, the staff at the EOC really wasn't implementing the sex discrimination prohibitions of the act. There were a couple of reasons for that. There were only 100 people there the first year. Most of them came there because they wanted to do something about discrimination against African Americans. The prohibitions against sex discrimination were only added at the very end of the legislative hearings before the statute was passed. The country really wasn't prepared for them. The people at the commission weren't there to do anything about women's rights, and they didn't have the knowledge of how to implement those provisions. They were much more complicated in implementing than the provision against discriminating against someone because he's African American. So basically, they didn't do anything about it. So this was the truth, but I was afraid to tell Betty. But then she came a second time, and she asked me again, and she came at a time that I was vulnerable. And I took her into my office, and with tears running down my eyes, I said to her that what this country needs is an organization for women like the NAACP represents African Americans. So in 1966, Betty and other men and women and I formed the National Organization for Women. Now,
tell our listeners a little bit about that. They may not be familiar with it if they're not from the United States.
The National Organization for Women, known as NOW, was initially started by 54 men and women. It now numbers 500,000 people all over the world. We don't have chapters in other parts of the world beyond the United States, but we have members. The initial purpose was to make sure that the EOC did its job and implemented the sex discrimination prohibitions against Title VII. But it has gone on to fight for women's rights all over the world and in every sphere wherever an issue comes up.
I know also that it helps women on a personal level because I know people who've called now, let's say if they needed a lawyer or if they needed some kind of advice that pertains to women.
Absolutely. They have branches all over the country. You can go on the Internet. If you type in on Google National Organization for Women, you'll get their website. And find out where there's a chapter near you and what they're doing.
Are you still working with them?
Yes, I now live in Sarasota, Florida, and I'm a member of the Sarasota, Florida chapter.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about the glass ceiling? Has it raised up a little bit, or is it still where it always has been?
Oh, I think there's no question but that things have improved for women. Because I think now women earn 77 cents to the dollar earned by men, and when I got into this field, it was 57 cents.
That's an international problem.
Of course. And I have felt for a number of years that the focus for our activity now has to be overseas. Not that we've achieved everything in the United States. We certainly haven't, but we've achieved a lot. And we are way ahead of women overseas, especially in developing countries.
I don't know if you know this. This is something that just happened recently in Spain. They've made a law that on the list, you know, when we have elections, we don't vote for individuals, we vote for parties. And they made a law very recently that the proportion of men and women has to be at least 40-60 on all these lists, which I think is a very progressive thing that we have in Spain that other places don't really have.
There are other countries that have similar laws. We don't have it in the United States, and I'm not sure I'd favor it in the United States, but I've read about it in other countries too. I did know about Spain.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about what you've written, because I know that you've written a number of books.
I've written one book, but many articles. I've written a memoir, and it's called Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter. And it's available, if one wants to order it online. There's both an e-book edition, and a regular soft cover and a hardcover edition. I have a website, which is www.erraticimpact.com. I'll spell that. erraticimpact.com/Fuentes. And Erratic Impact is spelled E-R-R-A-T-I-C-I-M-P-A-C-T.
Can you tell us very, very briefly about the book?
Well, the book begins with my parents' first of all, the book is humorous and serious, as is life. It begins with my parents' marriage in a small town in a village in Poland, goes on to our coming to Belgium and the United States, and then deals with my life in the United States.
You spoke here at the conference about how being an immigrant has impacted your life. Can you very briefly tell us a little bit about that?
Well, some years ago, in the year 2000, which happened to be the 50th anniversary of my graduation from the from Cornell University, one of the professors in the Labor and Industrial Relations School asked me to come back and speak to two of her classes. And that was quite a thrill for me on the 50th anniversary of my graduation to come back and speak to a class, two classes, but I walked into one class and my book was on everyone's desk there, including the teachers, and that was a very special thrill. So one of the classes had not read my book as part of the class, but the other one had. So I asked the professor, a very special woman and a feminist who subsequently died, her name was Jenny Farley, I asked her what I could talk about to the class that had read my book, since they already knew about my life. And she said, why don't you talk about how being an immigrant affected your life? And I was delighted at that suggestion because I've had thoughts about that all my life, but never put them together. So for that occasion, I put them together. What I talked about was that when you're an immigrant, it's both exciting and very difficult. It's exciting because as an immigrant, you're coming to a new country, you have new experiences, you meet new people, and you're having adventures. The difficult part is that you're an outsider to that new culture. And in a sense, you remain an outsider to that culture all your life. You've got one foot in the country that you came from and another in the country where you are. And I mentioned the fact that I often wonder who I would have been and what my life would have been like had I remained in Germany. I don't know who I would have been. I certainly wouldn't have been who I am. These are some of the things that immigrants go through.
Then, of course, it depends on your reason for being an immigrant, because there are immigrants by choice, there are immigrants by necessity, there are immigrants who are really refugees. So that must really have an influence also.
I'm sure that had an influence, but whatever the reason, you are in a country where you weren't born, mm-hmm. Your life has been uprooted, you have to make your way. When we came to this country, we knew nobody here, except we had some cousins in Brooklyn. My parents and I came with my brother. He was then about 18 or 19. He was the only one of us who knew any English. And we came into a strange country. My parents had no education, didn't know the language, and they had to make a living for themselves. And I am awestruck at how well they managed, and all the other immigrants.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing now or any plans that you have for the near future?
Oh, I am doing a lot of exciting things. I came to the Washington, D.C. area and lived there on and off for 40 years. But last October, I left that area and moved to Sarasota, Florida. I had been spending the winters there as a snowbird, but I finally, going back and forth twice a year, got to be too much for me, so I moved there permanently. And it's exciting to create a new life yet again in a new place. I am a member of the Sarasota Now, which I have mentioned. I'm a member of the Congregation for Humanistic Judaism there. And I'm going to a colloquium they're going to have in Detroit in October. I'm a secular Jew. I am in the National Council of Jewish Women. I'm a member of the Brandeis National Women's Committee. I work out with a trainer twice a week. I go to a water exercise class at the Y twice a week. I have a wonderful group of friends. I usher for two theaters in Sarasota, get to see a lot of plays. I will be featured in a movie that will be finished by the end of this year, a documentary.
About what?
About the second wave of the women's movement.
Uh-huh.
It will be the first comprehensive documentary about the second wave of the women's movement. It's being made by a feminist California filmmaker named Jennifer Lee. She plans to complete it this year and hopes to show it at the Tribeca Film Festival next April in New York City. A playwright is writing a play based on my memoir. So that's very exciting, too. I continue to write articles, I give speeches, and I have a very rich life.
Thank you so much, Sonia.
My pleasure.